Welcome to Best Practices. I'm joined once again by Adam Cherry, president and owner of Cherry Optical Lab in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Thanks for joining me, Adam.
Steve, good to be back.
My pleasure. So last time you were here, we spoke about best practices for lab selection and ongoing evaluation. That was a very insightful conversation. Thank you for that. Today, I would love to chat about lens selection. So a lot of energy seems to be spent on frame board management and deciding which lines to carry for the fashion element of things. Mm-hmm. And I don't see quite as much conversation around how to make a good lens menu, for lack of a better term, for your patients. So I'd love your insights on best practices for that. I know there's a lot of different avenues we could take. So wherever you'd like to begin, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, and hopefully you can steer the conversation a bit here because there's a lot of different angles and approaches that we can take and should be considered when we're talking about lens selection in particular. So I think probably one of the biggest things that I would start with is, building that lens from the core, meaning before we let ourselves drift off into the world of brands and technology is just core concepts of what products you want to support. And let me finally spit it out. The lens material, right? The lens material and then the high level features, I think are the quite frankly, the most important, right? Meaning, for instance, if somebody's high myope and we sacrifice thinness because we want to keep them in this premium branded progressive lens, you're going to miss the mark there, right? So I think matching the prescription to the gearing towards a more aesthetically pleasing solution, right? So lighter, thinner, clearer lenses, right? I think you're going to win or be on the right pathway with your patients there. And it, look no further than anytime they do, like, they don't do a lot of them, but patient surveys or consumer surveys about what they're looking for in their eyeglasses. And I think lightweight is always like one of the top, right? So if when you're building your lens menu, you haven't just kind of built lightweight into it by default, you're missing what your audience is looking for, right? So, it's kind of like serving beer and determining whether you want it to be cold or warm, right? You probably just default to cold and you'll be perfectly fine with all of your customers.
Right, right. The occasional person who wants a warm beer can just wait.
We can pour it and they can wait. We'll get there. That's right.
Yeah, I think that makes really good sense. And as you're talking about it, erring toward aesthetics, I think is under considered when deciding on which lenses to offer. I think a lot of opticians and practice owners think about getting the highest visual quality first and to the exclusion of everything else. And the highest visual quality is something that we can certainly talk about afterwards, but I do think that the aesthetics and comfort are lost if that's all you consider is visual quality. And I think what happens as a result of that, patients might be happy when you dispense the glasses and they've worn them for a couple of minutes. But if they wear them for an hour and they start to pinch on their nose or are uncomfortable behind their ears, maybe it happens a month later, maybe it happens a few months later. But if the weight ever becomes an issue, then that is a problem that I don't want to say you caused, but it is a problem you didn't help the patient avoid.
Yeah. And again, cost, price, all these things that factor in, it all comes into it, right? But you're spot on that if somebody's wearing eyeglasses that are not comfortable or they feel don't look good because the lenses are too thick, all the other challenges are going to come right behind it and shortly thereafter. Now, let's keep in mind the extreme majority of prescriptions, thin materials don't even really need to come into the equation, but lightweight. So things like Tribex lens material, even polycarbonate lens material, those check those boxes, right? We've been saying it for quite some time. Plastic, let's just regular old plastic lens material needs to go away, right? It needs to be relegated to, it needs to be sent to pasture, right? Because other than it's less expensive, as a manufacturer, I'll say something maybe I shouldn't say, it's not that much more expensive on a raw material basis. But I think that kind of complicates and gums up the whole works as far as how to present the products. Yeah, get plastic off your menu and you'll find your menus a lot cleaner and easier to explain. That's for sure.
What I would do back when I was running practices is I would set my CR39 price and my poly price the same so that there was no reason for anybody to use CR39 ever.
Yeah. And let's make sure to be very clear. That means you raised your CR, Jafal.
Yes.
Not go the other way. And no, do not try to find a happy medium. Bring the floor up.
That's then, right. Yeah. That's right. I know there's a conversation to be had about the Abbey value of poly, and without getting too nerdy about it, by and large, the vast majority of prescriptions can wear polycarbonate pretty well and not run into issues about it if it's a well-fit lens in a well-fit frame. I think taking lightness into consideration and importantly, as part of this conversation, the ongoing comfort of your patient, not just visual comfort, but physical comfort practice.
Yeah. You got it. And you asked me about lenses and I'm a lens guy, right? So I make lenses for a living, right? That's what we do. Part of the lens selection must be driven by the frame. It is wonderful as I'd like it to be in a world that everyone goes into their eye care professional and says, man, I can't wait to get some great new lenses today. The reality is people are looking for, they're looking for eyewear. They're looking for frames that are, maybe some of them are just highly functional. But a lot of people are looking for some combination of function up to the extreme where it's all about a look. It's a style that you're trying to create. It's a fashion, right? But it's the frame. So the frame can be the driver then of what lens avenue you go. So easy ones, right? Rimless eyewear, thin rimmed metal frames, drilled eye. Okay, well now thinness is really going to come into play for certain prescriptions because there's nothing to hide it, right? Conversely, right, higher prescriptions, you're going to want to steer people towards a frame that maybe is a little thicker, maybe a more round shape, like things that accentuate the features of the material that you're looking to use. Because we see it quite often where, and it's usually the higher myopes, but then, you can tell the patient wanted a certain look or style. Well, the patient picks a elongated rectangle or a bigger eye size. And it's like, oh man, like, all the 1.74 in the world isn't going to make that lens thin.
Right.
Because of the shape and decentration and things that get into it. It's kind of leaning in on your core competencies of an optician, in particular when you're getting into those conversations or prescriptions, I think guide the conversation. Last thought on that. I like to say, the best opticians that I know are really good at saying no to people. Right. You look at the prescription, you look at what we need to do to make it come out to be a great pair of eyeglasses. And when the patient's going around on the frame board, they go, nope. And you start steering them where you need to be. So
there's a lot of trepidation around doing stuff like that. In my conversation with Bill Gerber in episode 1, subscribe to Best Practices, he talks about how common it is for opticians and frame stylists and so on to x-ray a patient's wallet and make financial decisions for the patient without ever talking to the patient. I think similarly, there's trepidation of saying no to the patient when they make a decision that you as the optician know is not good for them. There's a fear of saying, well, if I say no, they're going to leave. I'll never see them again. I think that I don't want to say that's not possible. It is possible, but if you do it the right way and you explain to them why you're saying no, it'll actually win you points. It'll win you their trust and then absolutely, you become their optician. I think there's a little ongoing sales adage that says the customer is always right. But what people always leave off of that, the actual quote is the customer is always right in matters of taste. It's not to say that the customer can never be wrong. The customer's wrong all the time. We deal with customers, you know that. They're wrong frequently. That's not a slight on them. They're people. People are mistaken. It happens. But when you say the customer's right in matters
not
of
tech, curious customers, curious customers are right all the time. Yeah, certainly, probably somebody else.
Other customers. Yeah. When you say the customer's right in matters of taste, that's an indicator of the things that you should carry or the products that you should provide. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about here isn't a matter of taste. It's a matter of physics, where there's only so much lens you can get into a certain amount of space. And if the space in the frame makes the lens either ugly or heavy or unlikely to stay in the frame over a period of time or some combination of those things, you've created a negative patient experience, whether you said yes to it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, getting into that lens selection, right? Lens material, I think we've driven home how important that is and where you go. But, you know, other things, anti-reflective coatings, right? Now, thankfully, in my 20 plus years doing this, anti-reflective coatings have really moved to become a standard, right? In fact, it's commonplace to see an eye care professional that's 70, 80%, 90% anti-reflective coating. That's where you need to be, in my opinion. If you're not there, you got to figure out how to get there. And if that's a pricing strategy you got to look at, you got to look at maybe some alternative products. If there were one area that I would be willing to give up on some of that thinness and lightness, it would be anti-reflective coating, because it's one of the few products that we have that literally enhances the performance of the lens, right? We're trying to help people see better. Let more light through the lens. You can see better that way, right? So, for example, if I take my eyeglasses off, I do not need anti-reflective coating right now, right? But the moment you put something on, comes the benefits. So that's a great part. And then the other, you know, the other intangibles before we could get into brands and technologies is the photochromic conversation, right? Is that something that the patient sees as a convenience for them? Even more interesting or added to that conversation now is not just a convenience factor, but a style and a fashion factor. It took me a little while to warm up to the concept of like 7 different colored photochromics, and like, why in the world do we want that when 80% of them are still gray? But it's out there, and it's an element that you can offer now that maybe makes that frame color pop a little bit. Maybe it accentuates a feature of the patient with that color that comes out. Or, you know what? Maybe the person just really likes pink colored lenses. And now we can have a photochromic that can do some of that. So thin and light, matching the prescription, anti-reflective coating for everybody, photochromic conversation. And I think you have those, and then you get ready to get into technology and brand and you know, the minutiae of those.
I think that's absolutely right. Now, I want to jump back to the anti-reflective coating. So to your point, we've been in the industry forever. And in the forever that we've been here, the AR has gotten a lot better. I remember when I first bought it when I was a patient, it was, you know, be really careful with these, wash these before you wipe them. Don't wipe them with anything other than your microfiber cloth, and make sure you've washed them with this specific lens spray first, because there is this huge fear of scratching them and then having them craze and all of that other stuff. I think there's been a huge increase in the durability of the anti-reflective coating, and certainly the ubiquity of it, to your point that lots of practices are 80, 90% penetration. When you're looking at so when I was in practice, I had a package deal, sort of, not necessarily for pricing, but to make it easier for myself. When a patient was getting progressives, I had a progressive in mind, I had material in mind based on their prescription, and then I had the anti-reflective coating that I was likely to dispense for them. Is there a big, like, how big a difference is there between the top tier AR of a big brand lens house and the one just below that?
Oh, goodness. I might not be able to answer that. I could end up missing if I gave you too much information here. But Steve, you're right that they've gotten better, right? That in general, anti-reflective coatings perform so much better than they did 10 years ago versus 20 years ago versus 25 years ago. In fact, my father, having been in this industry his entire time, he likes to talk to people about anti-reflective coatings or progressive lenses. He's like, yeah, it must be nice to dispense them now because they actually work. Whereas when he was out promoting them 30 and 40 years ago, they didn't work so well. So a lot of it's the chemistry of the hard coating is actually what's really advanced the most, which the anti-reflective coating gets a lot of the front page publicity, but the hard coating or scratch coating chemistries has actually been where the big advancement has come that's added a lot to the durability and things to it. So you got a lens, you got a good hard coating on there. To a certain degree, whatever anti-reflective coating you're going to put on top of that is going to work as far as the anti-reflective performance side of it. Where we're getting at with the more premium anti-reflective coatings, that top tier in comparison to maybe the entry, is kind of refining and adding to the performance, meaning how much of the oleophobic, hydrophobic, anti-static layer is on there. Well, if it's a real value product, probably a little bit, right? Or none, up until your top tiers, well, they're going to have a lot of that, right? And it's kind of a weird thing because fresh out of the box, they all perform great,
right?
Right. It's that, how are they going to perform 1 year in, right? Month 18, right? Well, that's where having more of that easy cleaning property that's going to hold up over the life better than an entry level. And so you'll see the same thing when they get into scratch resistance, right? That the premium tier is going to have more of the scratch inhibiting layer of the anti-reflective coating. There is a limit that you run into with that layer that you, if you put too much of it, you actually then make the product susceptible to crazing, right? So you're seeing a lot of the manufacturers maybe hitting a little bit of a glass ceiling on that, right? And you're going to see some different chemistries and things being developed to try to enhance that side of it. Let's be real though. We're never going to create a scratch-proof lens.
Right.
I think if there's an area, pardon me. Thanks. Did I catch the cough button in time? I think I almost missed the second one there. But if there were an area that I think we could all improve as an industry, it's promoting an anti-reflective coating or any lens as like scratch proof, right? We shouldn't say that ever. But even the scratch resistance, right? The greatest coatings, the most scratch resistant coating that are out there, right? Number one, they only get that rating by way of like a standardized scientific lab testing procedure that isn't anything even remotely close to the rigors that your lenses go through in the real world, right? Right. Being mindful that when we sell an anti-reflective coating, we're not selling a scratch warranty.
Right.
Right. In that essentially, if you get a scratch, you can get a new pair, right? They are inherently scratch resistant. Excuse me, more so, I got to take a short break here.
Well, they are definitely
very much on brand, though, right?
All the way through.
So, where I should get to, if there's help conversation keep moving, is reserve the use of those scratch warranties and that performance to when it gets to a point that it's inhibiting or impacting the visual performance of the lens.
Right.
Right. I think that would be an area that would help our industry. Because I think when we're potentially over promoting the performance of a lens, it creates an opportunity to dissatisfy the patient.
Absolutely. Right. So much of what you're, what we talked about last time and what we're talking about here comes down to good communication, right? I think how you present the anti-reflective coating and the various features that it provides is going to be indicative of how the patient feels about it when you dispense them. In the same way that, you know, when I was in practice, I would talk to somebody about photochromic lenses, and I would tell them as soon as we were starting to have that conversation, hey, just so you know, they're not going to darken when you're in the car, so don't expect them to replace your sunglasses. And I'm telling you this so that you know what to expect when you get them. The same thing would happen when I would talk about anti-reflective coating. They'd ask, you know, is it scratch resistant? And I said, the single biggest determining factor in whether or not these lenses will scratch is you, actually. So scratch resistant or not, if you don't take care of them, they will scratch.
Yeah, absolutely. I would even say, and I sometimes joke about sunglasses in particular, is if you don't scratch your sunglasses, you're not wearing them correctly. You should be out in the world. You should be at the beach. You should be at the lake. You should be hiking. You should be bike. You know what I mean? Like, you should be in environments that things are happening to them. Safety glasses. Again, if your safety glasses don't have a scratch on them, well, how much safety do they really provide you there? Being realistic about the performance is a really big deal. But, you know, I get it, right? We produce these products and we sell them. And some of the wholesale pricing of these dictates a retail price that's getting up there, right? So if I'm working directly with a patient, and now I'm looking for $150 to $200 for just the anti-reflective treatment or coating, right? Boy, that I'm probably going to want to assign some amazing capabilities with that, right? So some of this we've kind of done to ourselves as an industry, where we've, I think there's quite a few products that the price point and then the claimed level of performance is so much higher than what is even asked for or needed.
Right.
Politely realistic, right? That, you know, we've kind of created this cycle where, well, we better promote that warranty then, because I can fall back on that for the reason why it's so expensive. So that's a lot to unpack. Absolutely. In that statement on just anti-reflective coating. But I think the other part with anti-reflective coatings I have missed out on is some of them are clearer than others, right? There's some residual color, so that's where you get into those premiums. And then the blue light reflecting aspect, that's something that's kind of out there as well. Steve, I see you're wearing potentially that product or one of those products. So it, yeah, that's an area that I kind of look at as well as the drivers of what's going on in the world of anti-reflective coatings.
But I think as far as best practices for designing your lens menu, what you just brought up is incredibly important and I think often missed. So a lot of practices have a high volume of vision plan patients, and often they make their lens selections based on those patients, and not necessarily for the benefit of those patients, but for profitability in using their vision plans. So without naming vision plans individually, you look at any of them and the highest reimbursement to the practice is on the most expensive, the newest products with the most stuff in it. Not necessarily the best lens for the patient, not a bad lens by any stretch of the imagination. Like all of the big manufacturers at the top tier of the vision plans, it's a great lens, but it might be too much lens for an individual. And if they were a private pay patient, you probably wouldn't fit them with that lens if you weren't concerned with the profitability. It's like, you know, somebody looking for a daily driver, you know, you wouldn't sell them a Maserati. They've got no need for a Maserati. They can't put their groceries in a Maserati or, you know, what equivalent, right? So I think there's a lot to be said for us as an industry having like priced ourselves out of a lot of conversations that then has led to the proliferation of online retailers that are really inexpensive. Not to mention the clarity of pricing. When Warby first got big, I think it was $80 for a complete pair of glasses. And even if the patient ended up buying something that was more expensive, they upgraded to something or another, and they ended up paying $150 or $200, they were okay with it because they knew approximately what they were going to spend going in. One of the most common questions I used to get in practice when I'd pick up the phone would be, how much are glasses?
How much?
I hated it having to answer that question. I hated being asked that question because to me, it's like, well, you wouldn't call a grocery store and ask how much food is, right? Because you got to be more specific. There's a lot that we can talk about. So I ended up narrowing our range as much as possible so that the patient I was talking to could have a sense of what it was going to cost them. Because an element that I think is under discussed is your average American today can't afford a $500 emergency, to say nothing of what might be an elective purchase.
Yeah. That's a lot to unpack. Maybe I should interview you for a while, Steve, here, because that was, but, you know, I think one of the first things you hit on is a little bit of this divergence that we're seeing between products used in vision plans, right? And if I were going to throw them a bone, right, the vision plans is, that is an area that has the best opportunity to deliver the most value to the covered patient, right? So there's kind of that weird dynamic where, you know, if you only include what's covered by a vision plan and the patient pays little to nothing out of pocket, the value that the patient's receiving is pretty minimal,
right?
Whereas if you do go to those flagship lenses, the latest, greatest technology, the category of whatever, we're going to have to come up, we're going to have to change over to like a completely different alphabet so we can have enough categories here. While the patient does have a copay, in many cases, those are where the patient realizes the maximum benefit, right? However, that then creates a scenario where the patient can become
reliant,
upset. They're disappointed because they think everything should be covered, and who are you to cover? Then that gets encapsulated by the reality that the practice within the vision plan has to be leveraging those products. Otherwise, they're providing their services for free or at a loss once you do it. So it's a really wild web that's out there. But having access to some data, you absolutely see that the private pay patient is being dispensed a higher tier of product because of the economic needs of the providers, right? I think more so than anything. And where I wanted to kind of bring that back to is, you know, again, now we're getting a little bit into, like, in particular, progressive lenses, right? Because single vision lenses, pretty basic. There's some digitals and things that are out there, and that's a whole nother conversation. Maybe you'll invite me back.
I'd love to.
When we're getting into progressives and lens pricing in general, is I love the branded stuff. I love the premiums. I think they absolutely deliver some great performance. Well, at the same time, I got to understand the business principles, you know, trying to understand what are the things my customers are dealing with. And when I look at an optical, an eye care professional, I look at their optical, they've got a lot of money invested into the frames that are on the boards. And let's be real, the frames that are in the drawers and in the cabinets and in the closet, and frames that are just kind of everywhere in an optical, right? If you have the market that allow you to do this, or you want to be creative, finding a way to move that inventory over as quickly and as many times as you can, right? That's how you truly unlock some different business successes that are out there. The mentality of selling the one great pair, it's noble. It's good. It happens in many cases. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But if you can take a practice that's primarily selling one ultra premium and adjust that strategy, if pricing is the reason you're not getting two pair, and elevate that two pair sales, number one, easy to say, right? Oh, yeah, wow, yeah. Adam, amazing businessman. He said to grow your business, sell two pair, right? No, it's perhaps you have to think of changing your philosophy on lens pricing and lens selection to make it more palatable to sell two frames. If you sell a lot more frames, amazing things will start to happen within your practice that get hidden in the minutiae of the finances. We've developed some different strategies with folks over the years using products that allow us as a manufacturer to pass through some of those savings that are out there, right? It's done some pretty neat stuff for folks that are ready to embrace that or feel that they've got a product offering or a patient base that would accept that.
Well, I think that it's a valuable conversation. I might ask you to get a little more specific here because I think for a long time, there has been a trepidation among seasoned opticians in particular, but probably lots of practices everywhere, that private label lenses, because they're unbranded, are somehow worse. Like categorically worse than branded lenses. And I think it's important that, you know, if we talked about in our previous conversation, evaluating the lab service quality, et cetera, and having your definitions for that clearly understood, does that same kind of approach apply when you're thinking about implementing a private label lens selection in addition to or separately from your branded selection? But I do think there's a conversation that needs to be had around private label lenses.
Yeah. You know, since we're talking about progressive lenses, I guess I have to do my obligatory thing where I remind people I'm contractually obligated to tell you that Verilux lenses are my preferred solution for presbyopia. But now that we've gotten that out of the way, even within that portfolio, there's a tremendous amount. But, since we're here to have a conversation about just stuff, right? And the term private label has probably been one of the more unique terms that I've seen used in that there was a time when some of the lenses and brands that we talk about today as the ultra premiums were brands that nobody had ever heard of, right? There were other lenses in that space when some of these brands were released. And I think the term private labeling, sometimes we just don't have a different word or we haven't come up with the other word, but I think it's been used to cheapen others, right? That, this lens brand, well, those are private label. The reality of what's coming when it comes to lens design, like the next wave that's coming, it's already in the European market for sure. It's coming to the US market where, Steve, I'd say, at what point are there so many private labels that they're not private labels anymore?
Right.
Right. Like it's one thing to be when there was one primary I call them legacy brands. Right. So the legacy brands, Essilor, now Essilor Exotica, Hoya Vision Care, Carl Zeiss Vision are kind of the primary legacies. And that encompasses a lot of it because they've kind of acquired. And
right.
So I think the legacy brand folks are going to have a hard time keeping the new technology folks that are coming out in a box. Right. Because the new technology folks are going to keep evolving just as the legacy guys are. The shift of lens design being something that's controlled and solely the grail of the big guys because they've developed the molds and the patents and things of that nature on the conventional old way of making lenses. When the patents expired on freeform technology a handful of years ago, the door swung open. Now you're seeing more and more companies coming to the table that have great engineers, they've got scientists, they've got optical professionals that are collaborating together to develop their own design principles. And that stuff's going to just keep coming. And I think it's going to drive some great competition. I think it's going to push all of them to create better and better lenses, right? But in the meantime, there's this space in the middle now where there are a tremendous amount of great options to consider at a lot of different price points. When I started helping my parents out with Jury Optical Lab, I remember I made the first price list structure in Excel that we actually just discontinued that format like this year. Oh. We finally, after 26 years, we just have a new price book that isn't built off of Microsoft Excel directly. And when we made that, we had three progressive lens categories. And we grouped all the progressive lenses that we sold wholesale into three categories based upon our cost to produce them. Our new price book has 12. And that has a lot to do with the wide variety of progressive lenses that are out there. It also has a lot to do with our industry never gets rid of anything, right? If you wanted a brand new manufactured in 2025 Explorer Super, I could make you one today, right? So some of that's hanging on. But anyway, a lot of great products, a lot of different price points, and it's kind of matching up those products, the performance of them, the price of them, to what you want your retail strategy to be. And the beauty of it is you can have multiple retail strategies at the same time. There is no right and wrong to this. There's just different solutions and different ways to get there that you can offer your patient. I don't know if I said anything though.
You said at least one thing that I think is really important, though. I think a lot of what you covered is important and I think largely unseen in the industry. I think people are exposed to exclusively the things they're exposed to in their day-to-day and don't necessarily go looking for things outside of what they know all the time, often because they're really busy or putting out fires or what have you. But the idea that that the patent on freeform progressives expired a few years ago and that blew the doors off, I think is really important for people to understand. Freeform digital progressive technology is available to anybody who wants to use it. And lots of people are using it to their advantage to create different visual systems for their patients or for their customers so they can create it for their patients. I think that's really important. I think the last thing that you touched on kind of as a capstone was match your products to your retail strategy. And that on its own as a philosophy is really important. It does, of course, necessitate that you have a retail strategy.
Good point, right? You got to have a strategy to meet the strategy. The strategy can be no strategy too, but it's going to be a little more dicey then.
That's right. Yeah, it's harder to know when things are going well. But I think a lot of what we talked about is really, really important. So let me recap this and tell me if I got anything wrong here. Start for best practices for lens selection. Build the lens from the core. That means understand the material and matching the prescription to the frames so that the lens material you choose will be right. Yep. Patients really want lightweight products, so focus on that and then think about the additional tech on the margins. Your lens selections for your patients must be driven by the frame. You can't high index your way into good frame selection is my read on that. Go ahead, Adam.
No, it made me chuckle every time. And that's a good line. You can't high index your way into it.
Think about the anti-reflective coating. That should be a high penetration option because it has the most material difference in actual performance. You know, an example that I used to give to patients who were struggling to understand what the anti-reflective coating did was there was a study done at some point that the coating for this patient had a high minus, but it can let in up to 12% more light through your lenses. You can lose up to 12% of reflection, of light to reflection. So I would say to the person at home, I say, go home and take your TV and turn down the brightness by 12%. You'll be able to see, but you won't like it.
Yeah. I like that.
It's because it's so hard for somebody to parse what it does, you know, and then things like the photochromic conversations. I also really loved what you said. Scratches on sunglasses mean a well-worn pair of sunglasses.
Kind of like a pair of boots. You know, if you got cowboy boots and they're all polished up, you know, those are the ones that you wear to Nashville. But most cowboy boots, they're pretty beat up.
That's right. That's
the ones that are beat up are the most comfortable.
And those are the ones that do the job.
Yes.
I think another thing that is really important, I want to hammer this home. If you sell more frames, magical things will happen.
Correct. how you get there, right, is part of that strategy,
right?
Right. But if your business strategy is we're going to sell the one beautiful best pair that's out there, love it. Let's go for it. Let's get all in on that, right? But if you want to try something different, if you want to have a real strategy about multiple pairs, you're probably going to need to address your lens pricing strategy a little bit. And that means going beyond 50% off the second pair, or whatever, like these de facto things that right. we've been trying. If those aren't yielding the results that you want, or you want to see if you can yield the result beyond where you're at, like you feel you're doing good, but you want to do better, I think that's where you gotta be open-minded to some alternative products that allow you to pass along those savings to the patient, knowing that they're going to take those savings and invest them into another frame, another set of eyewear entirely. I really love this concept because now you start to create a pattern, right? Where the patient gets used to buying multiple pair. Guess what? After a few years of doing that, maybe they want to put lenses in their old pair. Maybe they want to update them, right? You start to create a collection for the people that want to create a collection. And that's, it's got to be a longer strategy,
right?
Right. If it's all about the one sale right in front of you right now, particularly for private practices, that's, you got to know it's not about that. It's about relationships and things of that nature. So if you can help somebody build that collection, you're planting seed that you'll be able to harvest perpetually.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of momentum that comes with that, right? They're not a customer of yours and you turn them into a customer that has built like some motion. If they get more than one pair, they are even more down the path that you'd like them to go down, and they'll continue down that. That momentum ought to continue year after year, and building your retail strategy to facilitate that will pay dividends sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and as a lens guy, I'm here trying to say your best pricing strategy is to figure out how to sell more frames. That's weird, right?
It's definitely not what I expected.
Something wrong with me. Yeah. Oh, man. I hope I didn't put vodka inside here instead of water. But for real, it's what I believe, because the lenses will come along for the ride, right? The lenses will suit the need as they seem fit. But if we force ultra premium lenses on everybody, we miss that other opportunity. We miss Absolutely. That second pair of sale, that three pair of sale, right? But in the four and the five, we all have them, right? But those unique scenarios. But I think if I were to come on here and just reiterate everything that we've tried over the last 20 years or so I've been doing this, that'd be a disservice, right? I think we got to look at unique, fresh approaches. And I wanted to share some approaches that we've seen work. These aren't just hypotheticals. We've instituted these at places that just blew it out of the water.
Actual best practices. Adam, thank you so much. Adam, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. I know you're a busy guy. Yeah. If somebody listening to this wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Hey, pick up the phone and give us a call. You can check out our website. It's got all of our contact information on it. It's cherryopticallab.com. Or I'll throw my email out there if you're more inclined to do that. I mean, we're on digital devices right now. So adamcherry@cherryopticallab.com. So one long but memorable email address.
Excellent. Any last thoughts for the audience before we wrap this up?
I appreciate it. And hope you came up with a couple of neat ideas, and look forward to helping you out if you're looking to get creative.
Thanks very much.